All right, can you hear me okay? All right, comrades. Well, for most people in the United States, the American Revolution has been reduced to a summer barbecue, the 4th of July, with flags and fireworks and George Washington. And in school in the United States, we learn about the Boston Massacre, the Boston Tea Party, the Stamp Act, the ride of Paul Revere, the first battles at Lexington and Concord, the Battle of Bunker Hill, the Declaration of Independence, about the hard winter at Valley Forge, finally the surrender of the British troops at Yorktown, the U.S. Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and we hear about Ben Franklin and his inventions, and also about his adventures with the ladies in Paris and London. And that's about it. But obviously, this is a very superficial understanding of what happened, and it misses the essence of the question. Unfortunately, many historians, including many Marxists, they present a caricatured version of the U.S. Revolution. Many even deny that it was a real revolution at all. It's often presented as a power struggle between two groups of rich white men, with the eventual victory of the Americans, who, with a few cosmetic changes, pretty much just took over the economy and the government and established themselves as the new ruling class. Now, there is an element of truth to that as well, but again, only on the surface. Our task as historical materialists is to look beneath the surface. We have to unravel and understand the internal contradictions, the fundamental forces, processes, and class struggle that motivated and drove that revolution. In actual fact, the American Revolution was far more dialectically complex, far-reaching, and a fundamental social movement and transformation than most people give it credit. It was not a mere colonial rebellion. It was a profound political and social revolution, which rooted out the remaining traces of the monarchy and of feudalism, which were inherited by the only partially completed English bourgeois revolution. So the Americans at that time carried through the bourgeois revolution on a scale that had never before been seen. Although unfortunately we didn't get to cut off any heads, any king's heads in the process. Now, as Marxists, we are not economic determinists, but we understand that in the final analysis, the mode of production is the foundation, the infrastructure upon which rests the superstructure of society. Ideology, religion, philosophy, intellectual life, political parties, the law, culture, aesthetics, etc. These all interact with and condition one another. And at key turning points in history, quantity is turned into quality and vice versa. I'm going to give a quote from Marx, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, but I think it's a good starting point for the rest of the lead-off. It's from his contribution to the Critique of Political Economy, when he says, at a certain stage of development, the material productive forces of society come into conflict with the existing relations of production. Or, and this merely expresses the same thing in legal terms, with the property relations within the framework of which they have operated hitherto. From forms of development of the productive forces, these relations turn into their fetters. Then begins the era of social revolution. The changes in the economic foundation lead sooner or later to the transformation of the whole immense superstructure. No social order is ever destroyed before all the productive forces for which it is sufficient have been developed, and new superior relations of production never replace older ones before the material conditions for their existence have matured within the framework of the old society. So this must be our starting point in analyzing the dynamics of the American Revolution, or any other revolution, including those that we are living through and preparing for today. The American Revolution, it was a prelude to the Great French Revolution. It anticipated what was to come soon thereafter, all across Europe. And at the heart of the revolution was the antagonism between the remnants of feudalism, which are planted artificially on the shores of the Americas, and the new bourgeois society. In a way, you could say that feudalism broke at one of its weakest links. In a place where capitalist relations had developed to the point where they could challenge the remains of the old system. Now, feudalism did not develop organically in the Americas. There weren't centuries of the rule of lords and of kings and the tremendous power of the church to smash. But there are actually many aspects of feudalism that were alive and well in the 13 American colonies. For example, there was a system of entail and primogeniture, which were designed to keep property, inheritance laws to keep property within a single family line. There were tremendous landed estates, many of them far bigger than the biggest estates in Europe, some as large as 6 million acres, which is the equivalent of one-fifth of the state of Virginia, like one-fifth of Denmark maybe or something. In New York's Hudson Valley, there were huge manorial properties, with huge manors where the farmers, they didn't own the land. They just worked the property of someone else. In the western part, there were huge areas of land that were reserved exclusively for the king, even though had never been there. The tallest and the straightest trees were reserved for the king's navy. And in some cases, they were feudal dues, like quit rents, that were actually imposed and collected on people who worked the land. Quit rents, feudal dues, taxes. In 9 of the 13 original colonies, there was a state church. And the big landowners and the merchants, the big merchants, they wanted to be like Europeans, like an aristocracy. And as in Europe, it was a society with very clear hierarchies, very clear social obligations. And you want to talk about uneven and combined development. You had chattel slavery, indentured servitude on a mass scale. You had a combination of pre-feudal, semi-feudal, and semi-capitalist relations, all on top of a vast, unplowed continent, full of natural resources, and inhabited by millions of primitive communists who spoke thousands of different languages. Now, by the late 17th century, the English had a fairly firm grip on North America. They'd pushed out the Dutch, the Swedes, the Finns, the Germans, and others who had tried to gain a foothold. And up until the Revolution, most Americans considered themselves subjects of the British Crown. They may have had this or that disagreement with the mother country, but above all, they saw themselves as Englishmen, especially in relation to the French, who still controlled an important part of the continent. But although it was mostly English, it was a real ethnic and cultural melting pot, not to mention a class melting pot, from the very beginning of the country. As I said, you had Dutch, you had French, English, Scottish, German, Spanish, Native Americans, Africans of all different backgrounds, and more. You had all kinds of different people came to the New World. You had soldiers, you had artisans, farmers. This is an English lesson for the translators, English test. Bakers, machinists, criminals. You know about that, yeah? Lawyers, skilled craftsmen, unskilled craftsmen, traders, trappers, merchants, bankers, preachers, fishermen, smugglers, rich. Poor people too. Religious outcasts. And 35% of the people were either slaves or indentured servants. Now, all of this was put on a wild and often hostile environment with a very different kind of flora and fauna, not to mention the millions of Native Americans. So this led very early on to a very unique situation. You had unique social and cultural, political and religious institutions. And over time, these diverged from the mother country. And people started to think of themselves not just as Englishmen, But as a Massachusetts man or a Virginian, we have a Massachusetts man right over here. So over time, these peculiar institutions in this new world put their stamp on the people. But there was so much land available that it was hard to keep free labor working for you when they could just move west and get their own land. The rugged individualism and the frontier spirit that's typical of many Americans has its origins in this period. So this led to an increased dependence on indentured servants and on slaves. They started using more slaves and indentured servants. In 1676, 100 years before the Declaration of Independence, there was a rebellion in Virginia called the Bacon's Rebellion, in which black and white indentured servants united. They actually marched on the state capital of Jamestown and burnt it to the ground. And fearing that that class unity of blacks and whites, and since people with black skin would be more easily identified if they caused trouble or tried to escape, this began the preference towards having black slaves as opposed to indentured servants. So the class struggle was alive and well from the earliest days of the U.S. Over time, there was a growing national identity. There was a common history. The language started to diverge, as we can see. And eventually, there was the need for greater political and economic independence. So over a period of several decades, centuries, imperceptible to the people who were living through this process, a new society started to develop within the womb of the old. And once the material and objective conditions had ripened sufficiently, the subjective factor began to develop as well. That is, the consciousness, the revolutionary consciousness and the growing radicalism of the U.S. Bourgeois. And above all, the willingness of the laboring masses to fight against their conditions. A historian named Charles Andrews, I think, sums it up nicely in the following quote. It says, "On the one side was the immutable stereotyped system of the mother country, based on precedent and tradition, and designed to keep things comfortably as they were. On the other side, you had a vital, dynamic organism containing the seed of a great nation, its forces untried, still to be proved. It is inconceivable that such a connection should have continued long between two such yoke fellows, like oxen in a yoke. One static, one of them was static, the other dynamic, separated by an ocean and bound only by the ties of a legal relationship." So you had a young, fresh bourgeoisie sitting on enormous economic potential just waiting to be unleashed. But in order to unleash that potential for the benefit and enrichment of the Americans as opposed to the benefit and enrichment of the British, they required the more efficient and stable confines of their own nation state. Now, as for the British, they wanted to maintain their stability, their hierarchy, and the profitability of their growing empire. And they ensured this by exerting very strict control over their colonial satellites, especially when it came to access to markets, to credit, manufacturing, trade, and so on. As the contradiction between the new society and the old society intensified, the British tried harder and harder to keep their grip. They suspended political liberties. They censored the press. They set up arbitrary courts and imposed taxes. They seized properties. And they brought British troops in and put them in people's homes and in their cities. This naturally led to growing resentment amongst the colonists, and the desire for greater freedom, for greater autonomy. But in addition to the antagonism between the colonies and their master, as I said, there was also a class struggle developing from the beginning of the United States. Many of the first colonists were political or religious exiles, like the Puritans. the Puritans, exiles from the English Revolution. And they brought with them very revolutionary democratic traditions. Especially in New England, they established very unique or very interesting institutions like the town hall meetings, like a community assembly. They had armed people's militias and a relative degree of religious tolerance. But at the same time, from the very beginning, there was always a ruling class ruling over the rest of the colonists. And in that struggle between the classes within the colonies, the British always supported the side of reaction. For example, it was British troops that put down Bacon's Rebellion. So this growing sentiment of being a new nation, a different nation, cut across class lines. And over time, the up-and-coming American bourgeoisie was laying the foundations of the unprecedented explosion of the productive forces that came afterwards. And from our perspective, this was very progressive. It lays now the foundations for socialism. Now, the British would continue to dominate the planet for another 100 years or more, but the seeds of its eventual downfall from worldwide preeminence was contained in the separation from its American colonies. Eventually, America became a new rival and eventually outshone its former master. Also, the French played a very well-calculated role in trying to weaken their British rivals by eventually supporting the Americans. But the expenses that they incurred in helping the Americans in the Revolutionary War actually accelerated the bankruptcy of the French court, which then led to its own downfall and its own revolution. So by the middle of the 18th century, the United States, or America, was no longer a peripheral backwater of the world. By 1776, one in every four Englishmen lived in the American colonies. It had a population of 2.5 million people, and it was an important component of the British Empire. Now, the Americans had enjoyed for a long time the privileges, the special privileges of being part of the empire. But at a certain point, they outgrew their baby clothes and they wanted to stand on their own. So the colossal potential of America to become a powerful commercial and maritime power, like the British, was increasingly restricted by the British. The colonies were expected to trade exclusively with British merchants, instead of being able to trade wherever they wanted on the world market. They were forced to import expensive British manufactured goods. They weren't allowed to manufacture them at home. Even though they had plenty of natural resources and increasing ability to produce things there, they were expected to be just a supplier of raw materials. They were forced to borrow money from British banks. And many people, especially the planters in the South, the plantation owners, were terribly indebted and would never get out. And as the British imposed more tariffs and duties and restrictions, the colonists would try and get around these restrictions through smuggling and so on. But eventually even that was not enough. And these constraints on the development of the means of production and taxes imposed on them from 3,000 miles away became intolerable. Now, in Europe, England and France went to war, the Seven Years' War. In the Americas, it's known as the French and Indian War. And in the Americas, it ended in 1763 with the defeat of the French. 1763. So after that defeat, the French weren't so much of a threat anymore. After the defeat, the colonists weren't threatened by the French anymore. And the economy of the Americas was starting to develop further at that time. And right at that time also, the British wanted to impose new taxes to help pay for the war that they had waged to protect the Americans. Now, Americans only paid 1/25th of the taxes paid by people living in England. They paid 1/25th, 1/25 of the taxes that people in England paid. But even this became too much for them. You know, why should they take all the risks while people living comfortably in London got all the benefits? Now, many people in the colonies were very loyal to the British crown. They were called Tories, and we kicked most of them out to Canada afterwards. But they were doing very well. They were the representatives of the crown, and they got power, they got land, they got, you know, governorships and so on. But as far as the ordinary masses, they're not very content with their life. They increasingly were opposed to what they saw as the occupation of their country. So different layers of society started coming together in their opposition to the British. For a time, the interests of various classes came together. For example, around the Stamp Act, protests against the Stamp Act in 1765. This is sort of the period of national unity and sort of general euphoria and agreement against the common enemy. But ultimately, in a revolution, the question must be answered. What kind of change will come about, and in whose interests? Now, since the fundamental interests of these two groups were opposed to each other, eventually that unity was broken. Example, as we see in every revolutionary process, ultimately of reform versus revolution, of cosmetic changes to society or a fundamental change in society. And once the break with England actually came, it was even more polarized, with most of the rich Tories remaining loyal to the crown and most of the poor people siding with the rebellion. And the way that the rich and the masses expressed their frustrations was also very different. The rich, they wanted to negotiate better terms for themselves in relation to the British. But the masses, the urban workmen and the farmers, they increasingly took things into their own hands. The rich, they wanted to cynically mobilize the masses as a negotiating tool against the British. But the protests against the taxes and against the British became increasingly violent, and they took on a life of their own. As one historian put it, he said, "It became apparent that their agitation for commercial redress was unloosing social forces more destructive to business interests than the misguided acts of Parliament in London." Unleashing social forces more destructive to business interests than the misguided acts of Parliament. There were boycotts. The Americans, they would burn down tax buildings and other government buildings. There would be mobs of people that would take the British officials and tar and feather them. You guys do that here? And as in all revolutionary processes, the consciousness of the masses was being transformed. From reform to revolution, their demands became increasingly clear, and the political programs and representatives that they threw up shifted further and further to the left. So you started having the unity of the urban masses, of the urban workers and poor, and of the farmers and the frontiersmen. In addition, you had the support of the southern plantation owners who had been economically ruined by their debts to the British, and they were less afraid of the urban masses because they lived in the countryside and exploited slave labor. But the nerve center of the revolution, the beginning, was in New England, and especially in Boston. There were meetings in taverns and inns and coffee houses. The town hall meetings in New England became real hotbeds of revolution. In Boston, only 1,500 people were eligible, due to property qualifications, to attend the town hall meetings and vote. But as the more radical wing of the movement gained more influence, they installed galleries and thousands of people would come. It got so bad that, as one participant said, that there was not a single gentleman present at these meetings. And so the masses began to express themselves directly in defiance of the royal governors and their legislatures. The interest in radical ideas in the revolutionary press and in revolutionary pamphlets increased dramatically as the thirst for ideas grew. Pamphlets like Common Sense by Thomas Paine became bestsellers. And as things started getting out of control, some of the rich merchants who had supported the movement in the past, they started going over to the reaction. One of the key figures in this period was a guy named Samuel Adams, who was a beer brewer from Boston. And he's the one who organized the Boston Tea Party. He coordinated mass boycotts, not individual consumer boycotts, but mass boycotts of British goods and of merchants who sold their goods. He was one of the key people in convening the Continental Congress and helped organize what were called the Sons of Liberty and called the Committees of Correspondence, which were kind of like revolutionary branches in every part of New England. There was over 300 of these committees and correspondents in the state of Massachusetts alone. And Adams understood quite well the role of a revolutionary party, in a way, in embryo. I think he explains it quite nicely in the following quote. He said, "Our business is not to make events, but to wisely improve them." So the American Revolution was much more than a war for independence. It contained within it both internal and external components. You had the colonial national struggle against the British Empire, and within the colonies, you had a struggle for a more democratic and egalitarian order. And like all revolutions, it was a process. It was, like I said, it was decades of building contradictions, decades of contradictions building up, of small rebellions, of trade disputes, of threats and sabotage, and eventually an 8-year war. And the first battles took place even before the Declaration of Independence. After that, the revolution continued, because it was only 6 years later that they adopted the Constitution and so on. And even then, the consolidation of the revolution continued under the first presidents, under Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Madison. Bourgeois history tends to focus on these great men of history. Now, it's without a doubt, these individuals did play an important role, often a contradictory role. But as we'll see, as in most bourgeois revolutions, it wasn't actually the bourgeois who did most of the fighting. They weren't the ones dying for life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. It was the ordinary masses. The ordinary masses were the backbone, the real driving force of this revolution, even if, in the end, they didn't get everything they thought they would get. But for the first time in history, a colony of a European power not only rebelled, but actually defeated and won its independence, defeated the colonial power. Every other rebellion like this up until then had failed and had been put down. Now, the ideologists of the American Revolution were inspired by the Enlightenment in Europe. The American Revolution then became an inspiration for the European revolutions, but also for other revolutions in the Americas, in Latin America, in the Caribbean, in Haiti, for example, or even Cuba in 1959 was inspired by the American Revolution. Now, these days in the U.S., and maybe here too, if you hear the word militiaman, I don't know what you think, but in the U.S. we think of right-wing, neo-fascist, crazy Tea Party people with camouflage fatigues patrolling the border for illegal immigrants. But in the American Revolution, in the early days, the militiamen, they were also known as minutemen, because they were ready at a minute's notice to go to defend the community. They were a true example of the armed people. They were a real volunteer army of the masses. Now, remember, at this time, the British Army was the most powerful, intimidating, deadly force on the planet. And yet, this ragtag group of colonists, they did more than just harass the British with guerrilla tactics, with Native American tactics. They actually defeated the British in a handful of important battles. Now, none of their victories were crucial strategic victories that threatened the domination of the British. But they were important morale boosters for the colonists and their cause. Now, the first battles in the Revolution took place in a couple of places in Massachusetts called Lexington and Concord. And the British were actually on their way to arrest Sam Adams to prevent him from going to the Continental Congress, which would eventually declare independence. But these small skirmishes were a spark that lit up the colony's resistance against the British. These small battles were a spark that lit up the broader resistance. Boston was a city of maybe 20,000 people at that time, 25,000 maybe. And yet after those battles, 20,000 people from all around the area, from Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Vermont, they came and they surrounded Boston and they besieged the British army who were trapped in Boston. This was a true, again, a popular uprising, a mass uprising against the state power. It was the ordinary working men, the farmers, the mechanics, the artisans. It was an anticipation of the early armies of the French Republic. Now, eventually, they formed a real army, quote-unquote, the Continental Army under George Washington. And this was an attempt to exercise some control over the rebellion. But it was always a far less professional force than the British, than the Redcoats. But the colonists were inspired. They had something to fight for. They were fighting for freedom, for liberty, for a better life. And even those that didn't fight in the army, many people supported the cause. They provided food and supplies. They manufactured muskets and ammunition and cannonballs. They bought bonds from the new government, the Continental Congress, to help fund the war effort. However, again, as in all revolutionary wars, this was not a simple linear affair. It wasn't just the good colonists on this side and the bad British on the other side. It was a living struggle of forces. And the result of the war wasn't a foregone conclusion. I mean, you look at the Canadians, they still have the British Queen on their money. Now, as I said earlier, many Americans remained loyal to the British, and they wanted to remain with the crown. So it wasn't just a war against the British. It was actually, there was a civil war taking place in the Americas as well. Now, it's estimated that 400,000 Americans total fought in the Revolution. 400,000. But about 50,000 of them fought with the British.
Boo.
They supplemented the British regulars, and the British also brought in Hessian mercenaries, German mercenaries. Now, at some points in the war, George Washington's troops were only 12 or 15,000 people, and the Tories provided as many as 50,000 at some times. So that was quite a number of people supporting the British. The Americans, they lived in very bad conditions as well. They were plagued by disease, by starvation, by desertions. Poor leadership, a Continental Congress that was always fighting and wouldn't give them enough supplies, enough money. There was corruption. And yet, after 8 years, they finally wore the British down. And once the French came in with thousands of troops and the Navy, that tipped the balance. Now, a lot of people say that the Americans were completely incompetent during the Revolutionary War. It's true that the Americans spent most of their time, trying to avoid the British. And it's true that George Washington, he was no Napoleon. He was a lot taller, for starters. But he did have his moments, as well as wooden teeth. You gotta give the guy a break. He had wooden teeth, But most importantly, he understood the role of morale in war. And he knew how to play to public opinion. There were some key victories like the Battle of Trenton in New Jersey, which showed that in small engagements the U.S. The American forces could win. Just 1 week before this battle, the army was disintegrating and the rebel cause looked like it was finished.
Yeah.
So George Washington took his troops. He crossed the Delaware River and came down and surprised the Hessian troops that were there. And some people say that the Hessians, they were all drunk and hungover anyway. But they captured hundreds of these guys, and it was a big moral boost for the cause. As far as the British were concerned, I mean, they were even more incompetent. I mean, they were completely useless. Remember, no colony had ever defeated the British Empire, so they assumed eventually they would win, naturally. They were British. So they were much more concerned with the next society ball in Philadelphia or New York than preparing the troops to go fight, these jokers in the woods there. But ultimately, the side of right and the side of history were on the side of the Americans. The British, they had a conscript army, a mercenary army. They were fighting to preserve the wealth and the privileges of the Tories and of the British crown. British were busy with their own wars in Europe, and eventually they were worn down. So say what you will about, you know, the aristocratic George Washington and these other founding fathers, but it did take some courage to rebel on that scale against the British Empire. They would have been executed for treason if they had failed. But we, again, have to emphasize the key role played by the ordinary masses. Or as Sam Adams called them, the two venerable orders of men styled mechanics and husbandsmen, the strength of every community. Anyway, the workers and the farmers, that's what he's talking about. So I hope it's clear by now that the American Revolution was not just a simple disagreement between, wealthy gentlemen. And the social transformations that resulted from the Revolutionary War were also very significant. The social transformation that resulted was significant. It was not merely a political revolution, but a social revolution. In fact, in relation to the size of the population at that time, the American Revolution resulted in some of the biggest expropriations of private property in the history of the world. In the state of New York, for example, all lands of the crown were taken. 2.5 million acres of manorial estates were expropriated. One family called the Van Rensselaer family, their estate was the equivalent of two-thirds the size of the state of Rhode Island, a very large property. The Phillips estate, which was 300 square miles, it's like 500 kilometers. In North Carolina, in the south, a guy named Lord Granville, he owned one-third of the state. That was taken away. The same kind of thing happened in places like Pennsylvania or in Virginia. In Virginia, the Fairfax estate, which was 6 million acres, was taken over, even though he was not a Tory loyalist. They still took his property because it was a remnant of the old system. These properties were then broken up into thousands of small parcels and sold off. It was a far-reaching land reform, which is one of the cornerstones of the National Democratic Revolution. The inheritance laws I referred to earlier, entail and primogeniture, the inheritance laws, they were abolished. You had the rise of a new class of small independent farmers, and millions of dollars were expropriated in other forms of property, personal wealth, and so on. Now, the property requirements for voting were loosened up. You no longer had to own land in order to be able to vote. The state churches that existed in some of the states were eliminated. There was separation, at least on paper, of church and state. And even though slavery continued, and it gained a new lease on life early in the next century, slavery was abolished in six of the states immediately after the Revolution. Six. And thousands of slaves were granted their freedom also in the South. And legally, at least, the slave trade was eventually ended, even though it continued illegally. A nouveau riche appeared, a new ruling class, almost overnight, as the lawyers and the skilled craftsmen and the merchants and the bankers, they rose up to fill the vacuum that was left after the defeat of the British. Also, the vacuum that was left by the Tories who fled the country. They estimate that at least 100,000 and possibly 200,000 Tories fled the country, mostly to Canada, some to Britain. Now again, in relation to the population of the country, this was 10 times more people than fled the French Revolution. Possibly, it's definitely one of the biggest political and economic emigrations in history. In modern history. Again, these were the richest of society, the cream of the colonial crop. They estimate that at least half of the richest people in New England, the states in New England and New York, fled the country. Many of those Tories who did stay, they lost their wealth, their property, their titles, and they had to just become more or less ordinary citizens. So the young American bourgeoisie had power in its hands now. And it proceeded to establish the structures, the laws, and institutions that it needed to defend their interests and to enrich themselves, of course. And it used the state power. It took full advantage of the new state power to root out the old elements from the old system and to build really solid foundations to prepare for its eventual rise to domination. Previously, in the colonies, it was the merchant capitalists who dominated things. They bought cheap and then they sold dear at home. But now the groundwork was laid for the development of the means of production and manufacturing on a much bigger scale. Without the privileged access to the British Empire, they now had to manufacture things at home and develop their own institutions. They established the first national banks and a system of credit. And very early on, they established a national debt, which was the only civilized thing to do, and which we're still dealing with in these days in particular. But it wasn't all milk and honey in the New Republic. There was an economic crisis, quite a severe economic crisis after the war. Big fortunes had been made during the war through smuggling and speculation, and that all came to an end after the war, and they'd no longer had the protected status of being part of the empire. There were important incidents such as Shays' Rebellion. This is a mass uprising of discontented farmers in Massachusetts, and there were similar movements all throughout the states. There were ex-revolutionary soldiers, and they were very similar actually to the Levellers in the English Revolution. And they had this ridiculous idea that the property that had been won by the common exertion at all should be the common property of all. But if you want to read more about Shays' Rebellion, you can buy Marxism in the USA, which also has very good material on the American Revolution by Comrade Alan Woods. But this rebellion, it really scared the new rulers. They had a loose association of states. They didn't have a national military force that could put down this rebellion. And they really were ununited states. But after the rebellion, they adopted a new constitution, which had a much more centralized structure, a federal structure. It included powers such as the ability to raise an army to defend the country and put down internal rebellions. And similar rebellions in the future, like the Whiskey Rebellion, were put down very decisively as a show of force of the new state. Now, the rapacious and audacious nature of U.S. capitalism was apparent from the very beginning. A guy named Alexander Hamilton was the first Secretary of the Treasury. And this really was like putting the fox in charge of the henhouse. As I said, during the war, they had sold bonds to raise money. But these pieces of paper were completely worthless by this time. But Hamilton, he convinced the Congress to honor the bonds in full, to pay them out in full, but only after he had sent his friends around the country to buy up the bonds that weren't worth anything from everybody. Now, Alexander Hamilton was killed in a duel with a guy named Aaron Burr. But he was really the most ambitious. He was ambitious. He was amoral. He was a Machiavellian political maneuverer. But he was a real battering ram of American capitalism. And a really interesting, revolting, but really fascinating bastard, for lack of a better word. So in short, the basic elements of the bourgeois democratic revolution were carried out, establishing the conditions for the flourishing of capitalism on the American continent. You had a unified territory, a unified language, more or less, a currency, a legal system, and a centralized state apparatus to defend the territory. And with an entire continent to occupy and to exploit, there was plenty of room to extend the country and the capitalist system on which it was based. But in some ways, even to this day, the bourgeois democratic revolution hasn't been completed. For example, there's an institution called the Electoral College, where you don't actually vote for the President of the United States. You vote for these anonymous electors, technically, and then they vote for the President. To this day in the United States, women don't have the same rights as men. And of course, the continued existence of slavery after the revolution meant that a second social revolution was necessary. It was the American Civil War. Now, the historical task of the Civil War, the historical task of this class conflict, was to end slavery and establish a system of free labor throughout the continent, which then laid the foundations for the imperialist phase of American capitalism. Now, in the final analysis, the inner needs of the American Revolution were bourgeois democratic in nature. It couldn't go beyond the economic base that existed at that time. So given these objective limitations, many of the ideals that were expressed by the founding fathers or the radical pamphleteers, the ideas that inspired the masses to fight and to die, they were, in the end, ultimately, they were utopian and unrealizable. Nonetheless, there's literally a wonderful body of revolutionary literature that came out of this period, which put into passionate words, you know, the aspirations of the masses. And these are words that continue to inspire people today. And despite the many confusions that Americans have about the revolution, to this day, Americans believe in this idea of freedom and democracy. And the real lack of freedom and democracy will eventually spur them on to fight again for these things. Now, the Constitution eventually, you know, it disregarded women and slaves and Native Americans. But nonetheless, the ideas in the Declaration of Independence, for example, were very powerful. The idea that all men are created equal, that we all have the inalienable right, a right that cannot be taken away from us, the right to life, to liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, the original draft of the Declaration called for life, liberty, and property. But people like Benjamin Franklin, who was really quite ahead of his time, he was against including property as one of the main rights of men. So the much more abstract pursuit of happiness is what made the final cut. But Benjamin Franklin, for example, he thought that society was, quote, rather property was a creature of society. That it was a social thing, that it should be taxed in order to fund society. So many of the words and the ideas of the American Revolution will come back to haunt the American capitalist class today. For example, the Declaration of Independence, it says the following. Whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, that is, it's of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. In other words, if we don't like this government, we have every right to change it. The man who drafted the bulk of the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson, he believed the following. He said, "The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. It is its natural manure. It is its natural fertilizer, manure." He was also in favor of revisiting the Constitution every 20 years. They didn't see the Constitution as a final document that should last hundreds of years. He felt that as society changed and developed, the institutions should change and develop. So these were very bold ideas, especially in a time when the world was dominated by kings and nobility. Now, economic reality obviously eventually asserted itself. And the U.S. Constitution became the supreme guarantor of property rights. It's a really remarkable model of bourgeois democracy. of democracy for the rich, for the capitalists. And it's very cleverly balanced to give the impression of a much broader democracy without actually letting the ordinary rabble have much to say. Most of the founding fathers, they saw themselves, they really were admirers of the old Roman Republic. They were fans of the Roman Republic. And they saw themselves as a modern version of the noble patricians, and that they would wisely rule over the ordinary plebeians. But we know how the Roman Republic ended up, with the consolidation of power in fewer and fewer hands, and the eventual rise of the Roman Empire, and also the fall of the Roman Empire. So like all bourgeois revolutions, what began as a highly progressive historical development was eventually transformed into its opposite. The U.S. is now the most reactionary power on the planet. And it's one of the most undemocratic and economically unequal countries in the world. The Americans are now occupying other countries. They're fighting against enemies that don't fight fair. They fight like Native Americans. They have their own Hessian mercenaries, like Blackwater, companies like that. But this too will be dialectically transformed into its opposite. And I think as Marxists and as internationalists, we have to always remember that. So the real roots of the American Revolution should inspire us. It was an example of the class struggle. It inspired thousands of ordinary American men and women to fight and die to change their society. Lenin understood this. Lenin wrote a letter to the American workers. And here's what he had to say about the American Revolution. The history of modern civilized America opened with one of those great, really liberating, really revolutionary wars, of which there have been so few compared to the vast number of wars of conquest, which, like the present imperialist war, were caused by squabbles among kings, landowners, or capitalists over the division of usurped lands or ill-gotten gains. That was the war the American people waged against the British robbers who oppressed America and held her in colonial slavery in the same way as these civilized bloodsuckers are still oppressing and holding in colonial slavery hundreds of millions of people in India, Egypt, and all parts of the world. So the class struggle and the embryo of genuine working class consciousness was present from the very beginning in the United States. The U.S. now has a mighty working class, and its consciousness is growing. And this is precisely why the American ruling class have stripped the revolution of its real class content. They don't want Americans to remember what really happened. The role of the masses, the expropriations of lots of property. These kinds of precedents might give people the wrong idea, because the historical record shows that revolutions and expropriations of property are not un-American. So, comrades, there's many lessons I think that we can draw from the American Revolution that we can apply to our understanding of revolutions generally, and which can help us in preparing the revolutionary subjective factor today. The American Revolution, it was the first clearing of the decks of capitalism. This was a historically progressive development. It was further consolidated by the Second American Revolution, the Civil War. And now the ground is being prepared for the Third American Revolution, the Socialist Revolution. Now, the American Revolution, and I'm talking about the one that's developing right now, is an indispensable part of the World Revolution. And I think, comrades, you should have absolute confidence that the American working class will do its part in helping to achieve the liberation of the whole of humanity, to free the planet from the chains of capitalist exploitation, and to completely transform human history forever. Thanks.